This week's episode of the Fitcast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com, BlackStarLabs.com, and by StrengthCoach.com. Hello, welcome to this week's episode of the Fitcast. This is episode number 137. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and first back with us is Jonathan Fass of AcceleratedStrength.com. What's up, John?
What's going on, Kevin?
And also, back after a week off, we got Lee Peel of now officially at LeePeel.com.
Kevin?
Lee's mad at me on the off topic. Lee, are you really mad at me, man? I'm sorry.
I'm just going to let you wonder. How about that? I'm going to let you just sit in that bubble of uncomfortability.
Fine.
Is that even a word?
It is now.
Damn right.
We got a special guest with us this week, Alan Aragon, who has had over 15 years of success in the fitness field.
And excess, too. Don't get it wrong. Excess as well.
I'm trying. I'm doing my best. Alan is the continuing education provider for the Commission on Dietetic Registration, National Academy of Sports Medicine, American Council on Exercise, and National Strength and Conditioning Association. He maintains a private practice designing programs for recreational, Olympic, and professional athletes, including the Los Angeles Lakers, LA Kings, and the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. Alan is a contributing editor to Men's Health Magazine, where he has a monthly column called Ask the Weight Loss Coach. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a long time in the making, but I'm glad that we can finally get you onto the show. Let's, you know what, we're not even going to do FitCast news. I'll record that later, and we're going to just get right into the questions with Alan. So the first question that we had was literally sent in by an anonymous person who didn't want their name read. So the first question, once calories, protein, and essential fat is set on a diet, how would you fill in the rest of your calories if one was in a bulk, eating above maintenance and minimize fat gain? And how would that change if they were in a deficit and trying to preserve lean body mass on a cut?
Okay, well, entire books are written based on that question.
Well, you have 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, in the beginning, people have to realize, you know, they have to get a realistic perspective of how much muscle they can gain and how much fat they can lose in a given period of time. And, you know, a lot of this is determined by their current training status or their current conditioning status and or weight status. And so let's take muscle gain, for example. And can you guys still hear me? I feel like I unplugged something here.
No.
Okay. We're sitting respectfully in silence listening to the wisdoms.
Sweet. Okay, so when we're talking about muscle gain, I'm talking about, like, not rebound muscle gain after months of dieting. I'm talking about bona fide net gains in muscle tissue during full-grown adulthood. So it's very rare for any full-grown adult to put on 50 pounds of lean muscle in their entire training career. It's very rare for people to exceed that. I mean, yeah, I've seen 60, I've heard of more than that on enhanced guys, but generally speaking, it's very tough for a natural trainee in adulthood to put on more than 50 pounds in an entire training career. Wouldn't you guys, I mean, do you guys agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
50-ish?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, if you can imagine somebody graduating college, let's say at a lean 180-ish, and very rarely you're going to see him turn the corner 10 years later at a lean 230 without drugs. So figure in a 10-year span, let's say from the early 20s to your early 30s, the best gain that adults can realistically hope for is an average of like 5 pounds of lean meat per year in a 10-year span. Mm-hmm. And even with drug-enhanced guys who can raise that ceiling, you're still topping out on an average of 6, 7, maybe 8 pounds a year for a certain period of time. And, you know, when you really think about this, the idea of stuffing yourself silly for the sake of bulking for a few months, yeah, man, I'm bulking, I'm going for that pound a week, man, you know, it really begins to sound silly. So, I've never really been a big proponent of the general population alternating bulking and cutting cycles. Now, for competitive physique athletes, it's a totally different story because, you know, they need specifically different seasonal protocols that attack a very specific objective. I mean, they definitely need a pre-contest phase. They definitely need an off-season phase. So it's totally different when you're talking about competitive bodybuilders, but that's just a small, tiny, tiny fringe population. And when the general population thinks that they have to continuously be either cutting or bulking, well, you know, that's not necessarily always the case. Let's see. Now, gosh, where am I going with this? Okay, so with muscle gain, if I were to just sort of pick numbers, you know, when you hear these questions, you know that the person wants to hear a number of calories or grams or stuff like that that they can write down and just file away in this little cue card, you know, that they can whip out from the back pocket. But that's not, it doesn't necessarily work like that. But if I were to kind of distill it down, if somebody's really ectomorphic and historically has a bitch of a time putting on mass, then shoot for a daily surplus of about 600 to 800 calories, split evenly amongst the macronutrients. And for the endo guy who, you know, gets fat from watching the Food Network, then I'd be a little more cautious, and I'd shoot for about 300 to 500 calorie surplus. Again, on average, across the week, you can do it linear or nonlinear. That's really just personal preference. And once again, isocaloric amounts of carbs, protein, and fat over that surplus is probably the safest way to go. And I can get more specific, complex, and, you know, more theoretically accurate. But in the end, I know that these questions are really in search of some kind of take-home sound bites. So about 600 to 800 surplus for the ectos and about 300 to 500 surplus for the endos. For bulking, as it were. And so we go on to fat loss, which is a totally different story. I mean, you, depending on just how fat you have become, fat can really fly off your body very fast at the beginning if you're obese or morbidly obese, and just kind of stratify the whole thing. Obese folks and morbidly obese folks can lose 3 to 5 pounds a week. And this is lost with a reasonable retention of lean mass. And I'm going to interject and interrupt myself all the time here, but there is a distinction that should be made between non-essential lean mass and essential lean mass, with non-essential lean mass being the water and glycogen component mainly, and the essential lean mass being the contractile stuff, you know, the actual muscle protein. So when people lose non-essential lean mass, it's really not that big of a deal. It's really not that big of a threat to health. So in any case, obese people, 3 to 5 pounds a week. Moderately overweight people can lose 2 to 3 pounds a week. Average and slightly overweight folks, they can lose 1 to 2 pounds a week. And lean folks can lose about 0.5 to 1 pound a week if they're lucky. So again, it's got to be stratified like that, and whenever I draw up calories, whether it's for, you know, the goal of gaining mass or losing fat, I always base it around the maintenance requirement of the future physique or the maintenance requirement of the goal. So you just build everything around the maintenance requirement of what you're trying to achieve, and then you don't necessarily have to institute these arbitrary cuts in calories that you reach equilibrium. Okay, put it back down again. I tend to just sort of, you know, find the theoretical needs of the maintenance requirement of what you want to be, and just go for it. Just do it and make the adjustments as necessary from there. So when somebody asks, you know, what kind of surplus or deficit, how would you establish, you know, once protein and EFAs are established, what we do for cutting and bulking and stuff, I just sort of wipe that all away and go, just establish the requirements for the maintenance of what you want to hit, period.
And that'll do it for this week's FitCast, as Alan has just answered every conceivable question possible for this week. That was fantastic.
Thank you, sir.
Although, you know what, I think, and it's a good point, too, because I think a lot of times every week we sort of get questions, and this one wasn't necessarily like that, but we get a lot of questions, or you'll see a lot of questions posted on forums where people are very specific. They want to know exactly what, just like you said, like a sound bite, and they're looking for this optimization of their plan. And most of us, I would say, probably don't work that way. It doesn't happen that way. And it was I think excellent advice and discussion there, because it's not always is this specific. And I've done everything now. Where should I go from here? What should I do from there? Just like Alan just said, just, you know, what is your maintenance and what do you need to do, and just add a little bit there, and let's take it for a ride and see where it goes. And it doesn't always have to be as formulaic as people make it out to be.
Yep.
Well, I don't think people want to, they feel like they'd be wasting time having to feel around for it. They just want that immediate, like, definite, these are the numbers that I'm going to have to be on, and that's it.
But you know what? Dieting isn't pizza, Kevin.
I agree. Yeah. It isn't pizza, John, no.
You can't put the exact number of pepperoni to make a perfect slice.
I'm sure you know that number.
Yeah.
Sure, words have never been spoken.
That's true.
Hey, Leppel Hill.
Hey.
You got the next question for us?
I got the next question, yo. Oh, God. Leppel Hill, a lady you have on the show, recently quoted on her blog that Alan Aragon said, if sloth and gluttony are not factors in obesity, then what is? That was supposed to be said in his review, of which I do not have access to, titled Tobes versus Science. Can Alan clarify that statement in light of the research body that exists, finding much to be involved in obesity that has nothing to do with sloth and gluttony? I'd like to hear his no-nonsense take on this research, as well as Tobes' discussion of it as well. Thanks, Robert. You can blame me for that question, Alan.
Okay, well, basically, this interview by, let's just call him Joseph Brandenburg. What's going on, man? I know he's bought my book, so I have a tiny bit of a soft spot for him, even though he went slightly by the wayside with this latest interview. Taubes interview in T-Mag, it just kind of made me go, whoa. You know, I had this whole schedule of what I was going to write for the opening article of my research review, and I just couldn't get past this interview of Gary Taubes basically saying that what did he say? In a nutshell, he says you won't get fat if you eat excess calories. You know, he's basically saying you're not going to store this energy, or you're not necessarily going to store this energy if you overeat. However, if you mess with the dat dare insulin, then you're going to get fat. And so, on paper and stuff, it seems plausible maybe that there's some sort of a hormonally based mechanism that would enable you to get fat regardless of thermodynamics. You know, that sounds kind of cool. However, when you look at the research evidence that compares diets with drastically different insulin-generating abilities, and you see no significant difference, period, in body weight, body fat, for the most part, on the whole, the evidence on the whole, especially over the long term in studies carried out over a year, then you just kind of go, okay, well, that whole insulin is king theory sounded good, but when you look at the actual evidence, it doesn't pan out. So that way, when you look at the evidence and you kind of work backwards, you kind of say to yourself, well, okay, well, I guess this thermodynamics thing is still hanging in there as far as what we've been able to measure and demonstrate in the lab. So my main response to the whole Taubes insulin carbs thing is that, okay, that's great. You can say that all day long, but the evidence says different. The research evidence says different. And anybody can come in and give their personal testimonial of how they just kick carbs out of their diets and they got in great shape. But ultimately, it will be because of whatever adjustments they made happened to influence thermodynamics in their favor, whether it was an increase in satiety as a result of increasing protein and or fiber, and just by default having less of an appetite, consuming less calories, which is usually the case, or whether they just adopted a new plan and got all excited and started training harder and more consistently. It could be any number of variables, but it all dovetails towards the energy in versus energy out equation. One of the things I didn't mention in this latest article was the pharmacological effect of insulin suppression on body fat and body weight gain. And so far, there's only two studies examining that. And one of them showed that, well, if you suppress insulin secretion through pharmacological means, then you can affect fat loss or weight loss, or you can promote weight loss. And then another study, the more recent study that came out, showed that it still doesn't do a damn thing, even if you pharmacologically suppress insulin output. So even when you go straight to the source, and those studies weren't terribly well controlled in terms of dietary intake anyway. So, but my point is, even when you look at the action of drug suppression of insulin, there's still no clear-cut advantage of suppressing insulin output on body composition or body weight. So, theories are what they are, but evidence is what it is too.
Anyone to add? And another knowledge bomb? Leppel Hill?
I 100% agree, that's for sure. I constantly am irritated by the complete ignoring of variables in these kind of situations, and when people hop on the low-carb wagon and they claim... I saw that Larry King interview that he did, and he basically was like, I couldn't lose weight until I dropped the carbs. And that means absolutely nothing. And people constantly use that as some sort of verifiable source that carbs were the bad. And they completely knock out the fact that most of the time they're using scale weight, and dropping carbs will lower your scale weight, like, automatically. They completely toss out the fact that it is a lot easier to miscalculate your intake or to, overdo your intake with carbohydrates. That doesn't mean that they're bad. It just means that, it's a lot harder to correctly account for your caloric expenditure with carbohydrates versus, protein. And I just, I love articles like what Alan wrote, and that gets into the research of it, and that really examines in depth why these things over and over again and time again cannot be cherry picked, and it is what it is. And I think that it was definitely, Alan, one of your best pieces that you ever wrote.
Well, thanks, Lee. And I want to add to this that one of my big contentions with Taub's position is that he just has this singular solution for everybody. Cut out the carbs.
Yeah, one size fits all.
Yeah, he's got this one size fits all thing when if you've worked with more than five clients in your lifetime, you'll know that there's a pretty wide variation regarding what people do well on as far as diet goes, as far as weight loss goes. Some people will thrive on the high carb thing. Some people will just totally just blow it. If you put everybody on the standard pyramid thing, which, by the way, is what us young nutrition majors were encouraged to do a million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But you find out right away that people really are different. There's a pretty wide margin of variation with respect to how well people will do on high carbs and low carbs and stuff. So yeah, that's a big thing with Taub's thing. He's got this one-size-fits-all philosophy that I disagree with.
So what would you say when those types of diets work? What's the mechanism at hand there? Is it simply a calories in, calories out statement, or is there what else is going on for those individuals?
Yeah, initially it's a pretty massive water loss from the glycogen storage. And then, and generally speaking, the most satiating macronutrient is protein.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the body of research as a whole, they're not really comparing just differences in carbohydrate. What they're comparing is a, you know, protein adequate diets with protein deficient diets. And so when you don't match the protein intake, then you pretty much, you have a flawed design from the outset. Because adequate protein is going to trump inadequate protein on a number of fronts right off the bat. So, you know, the lesser of the, I guess the two evils you could call it, would certainly be sufficient protein versus a low protein, high carbohydrate, low fat. So what really needs to be compared in more studies are sufficient protein or even ample protein in the training population and variations in carb dosing, maybe even a dose response type of setup for a wide range of athletic pursuits, whether they be endurance or strength, etc. So we can kind of get an idea of sort of who needs what in terms of carb requirement. But we already kind of know that in practice. Like the endurance guys need about double the carbs of the more maximal strength guys, and the Zoolander type guys need psychological help. So yeah.
Cool. Next question comes to us from Roger, and Roger asks, "What do you consider to be your most fulfilling moment in the fitness industry wise, and what direction do you see yourself heading within the next few years? P.S. Your research review is the best thing since Outback Steakhouse."
I like that. One of my dad's birthdays was at the Outback, so kind of, I like that comment. Okay, most fulfilling moment industry wise. That's a tough one because I've been doing this since 1990, and in other words, I'm about double the age of the bodybuilding.com population.
Yep.
there's a ton of fulfilling moments. I mean, just to kind of name a few. Getting picked by Men's Health to replace their weight loss coach was kind of a big deal for me because I didn't have anything going for me really other than my forum posts. So it was kind of shocking for me to think, damn, this is the largest men's magazine in the world, by far. And they could have picked anybody to be their weight loss coach, but they picked me. And so that had a pretty profound effect on the perspective I had of whatever impact I made with my posts on the message boards. And let's see, other stuff that had a major impact on me. I guess it would be gaining the respect of the tough critics out there, you know. It's kind of hard to achieve in internet land where it's so easy to take pot shots at people and just stay anonymous. It's so easy to just shred people, you know. And I've been able to somewhat avoid that, and it's not really an intention of mine to be universally adored, but so far, you know, I've gotten some props from most of the corners of the online globe here. So I'm happy about that. And then finally, the other thing was being invited to speak at various events like the JP Fitness Summit and various universities and stuff. It's just sort of, I don't know, feeling the love, you know.
So, yeah. Asked to do the FitCast, maybe. Yeah.
I think that could be
an achievement.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I was this is my first podcast. I've done something else before with Lyle and a few other dudes on this sort of just phone conversation that was just pretty much disastrous and stuff. But this is probably my first high profile recording where people will get to see how much I stutter, stammer, and equivocate. So I was pretty nervous about this, but also really excited about it too. And it sort of makes up for the fact that I had to be up and ready at 7 a.m. Pacific time.
Sorry.
If it makes you feel any better, I actually keep a post-it on my computer screen when we record that says, "Don't say And it doesn't seem to work too well, but I do have that there, so.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Should probably implement that strategy.
Post it being made right now.
Yep.
The next question that we have comes from Jimmy. Alan, how much do you think the ever-evolving field of genetic testing / profiling affect our current understanding and client recommendations for diet and exercise? I mean, are we really that different genetically, or are we just focusing on the minutia? Love the show.
Well, if I was profiled, then I'd probably be mistaken for being really good at math all the time. So that kind of sort of reflects how I feel about profiling in the genetic sense. It's a shot in the dark. There's just a preliminary level of research on nutrigenomics. And of course the guys involved with the products and the protocols are going to be extremely excited about it. And they're going to say how everybody has their own genetic fingerprint signature, if you will. And in theory, there is this perfect diet for everybody that'll prevent disease and optimize health just based on a series of diet gene matchups. But I think that the psychological component to eating can override most of that stuff anyway. You can get your genetic consultation and be told, okay, you have to eat this, 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 and that. You have to not eat much of this, this, and this, and that. And if you don't like it, you won't sustain the program. You'll be miserable. You'll be dragging your feet, cursing under your breath, and your mood will go to shit. And the whole genetic perfection there doesn't even really matter. And I know I sound cynical about this whole thing, but just from designing diets in private practice for such a long time, I found out that what you have to do is design plans around the individual's personal preferences, and you actually have to design plans around what they absolutely love in terms of food. And of course there's lines you got to draw. Some people love Krispy Kreme donuts and Twinkies and, you know, things of that nature. But when it comes to whole foods and minimally processed foods across the spectrum of the groups, you really have to just respect what people like the taste of and build your plan around that. That's the only way it's really sustainable. Let's see here.
Do people really like Twinkies? I've never met someone that does.
I used to like Twinkies. And think about this. Combine this with the fact a wide range of protocols, diet protocols, can arrive at identical results. You know, how much more different is somebody's diet protocol for, let's say, long-term health going to be than eat a wide range of the food groups, eat a relatively good balance of the protein, carbohydrates, and fats, and keep your foods as minimally processed as possible within reason. How many more times are people going to tell you to, you know, get the right kinds of fats, get your fish oils in, get your fruits and veggies in, and get enough protein, and combine that with enough physical activity, and you'll be perfectly fine. I mean, there's this sort of regression towards the mean that's going to happen when people try to get as healthy as possible. And so with this paradigm being just sort of a bleeding towards simplicity, nutrigenomics, all it does is just complicate shit, make it a pain in the ass, and make it more fucking expensive.
Yep.
Damn right.
Yeah. I'm about to throw my computer out the window. I'm so pissed.
Don't do that, John. That's
I completely agree. You know, most of the time, too, these things, be it as simple as the blood type, right for you diet or you know, any sort of more extreme measures of testings with labs and facilities, all it is you know, you're going to need a few less carbs in your day, you're going to need a little bit more fat in your day, which is all shot in the dark stuff anyway, and not at all tailored to a person's you know, kind of their personal desires or needs or anything that they've, you know, truly experienced firsthand with use. And if you really want a genetic modified diet, you know, take a little out, add a little in, and see how you feel. And there you go. It's your personal tailored diet.
Exactly.
I think it's amazing that people want to pay thousands of dollars to be told, you know, start here.
Yeah, yeah. And Lee, I think you could agree that it's mainly a shuffling of proportion of carbohydrate within the diet.
Yeah, it's always that.
Individuals.
Yeah, it's always
not going to be eat more tomatoes, eat less onions because they have this gene. You know what I'm saying?
Most of the things that I have seen have ended up coming out, you know, because I know a lot of guys who get into this whole thing, and they're like, oh, in our labs we do this, and it's always, oh, you don't get to eat starch, really? That's thousands of dollars, and you want me to avoid starch carbohydrates? Okay, because why? You know, they bloat you. Okay, you know, there's never an actual any sort of reason. It's always, oh, just take off this and you're going to lose weight just fine. And sure, it can be achieved because, let's be honest, a lot of starch carbohydrates are very calorically dense, and you know, it's really easy to get your extra intake of them if you overeat them. But that's the key: overeating. You have to overeat them for it to be an issue. So. Yeah, I just, that stuff just always really, just really bugs me. You know, I think that it can be made so much simpler by just going, you know, take a little out here and add a little there and see how you feel and react. But
exactly. Yeah. I'm not anti-technology by any means. It's just this sort of thing is perfect for, just complicating stuff, making it expensive, and making people more neurotic than they really need to be.
Absolutely. Well, Alan, if you only had 5 supplements to take, what would they be? And what is the difference between whey and casein protein? And is one preferred over the other?
Okay, well, I'm going to criticize these questions as I hear them. But why would somebody want to take 5 supplements? You know, and I know that's not necessarily the question, but if I had to take 5 supplements every day, I would kind of worry about what the hell I'm doing that for, given that I'm not in competitive sports. My livelihood isn't on the line necessarily depending on one supplement or over another, or this supplement or that. And I, you know, those are the kind of questions I'd ask myself. And of course, you know, if I had it in my budget to just throw in some extra money to throw away on supplements, it would probably be more like 2 or 3 rather than 4 or 5. So with that out of the way, I would take a multivitamin. There's some controversy surrounding just how useful that is. And there's plenty of populations all over the world who don't even go near a multivitamin. They live right long lives. But if I were forced to pick a supplement, a multivitamin would be one of them. Protein powder is not really a necessary supplement. It's just one of those things that if you are pretty big on convenience and you're not that big on cooking and chewing and planning and things like that, then protein powder is a great supplement. There are certain fringe populations who can benefit from a protein powder intra-workout during an endurance type stuff. So, you know, leave that for them. But protein powder is I'd say that's the second supplement that I would go for. It just makes things easier. For those who don't eat fatty fish regularly, then fish oil it's just got too much research behind it to deny. And when you look at the populations who have the greatest life expectancies and the populations with the greatest cardiovascular profiles, and there's always this kind of common thread of the marine oils. And so, again, if you were to choose a sub, fish oil would be one of them. But I want to add to that I personally, in my clairvoyance, I bet you if I stopped taking this nasty-ass fish oil, I might even live longer. So anyway. creatine, another one of the supplements that's just got tons of support over decades and decades of research, tons of different independent labs. It's not like HMB or even beta-alanine, who a compound that, that really has sort of this clustered source of research that comes out from either EAS or NAI, and both of those guys, you got the manufacturer going, you got the distributor going, you got this network of science and commerce going. That's sort of the beta-alanine machine, but I'll give beta-alanine that it really is cranking out a pretty consistent level of research showing positive results. But then again, why are you going to take it? Are you in competitive sports that would that have that much at stake, where you would take beta-alanine in the face of very little safety data? So we've got multivitamin, protein powder, fish oil, creatine. One more would probably be some sort of bone building mineral or mineral concoction, calcium, vitamin D. And that pretty much rounds it out. Potentially magnesium, and that'll round it out. I don't believe in any of this other crap. I was over at the vitamin shop the other day, and a bunch of bros were checking out the protein powders. And so I just eavesdrop in on them, and one of the guys says, hey, you know, get this Pro Ball at 12-hour thing. And so I never actually looked at the label on the thing. But this probiotic stuff, no offense to whoever the hell makes it, it happened to be $30 for a 2-pound tub. So nowadays you can get protein powder for half of that. You can get whey for half of that price. So I looked at the ingredients, and the very first ingredient was soy protein. Now, not that I'm the major soy protein hater, but there's no reason on God's green planet why you should be paying double for soy protein primarily rather than whey. So I had to interject. It was one of those moments in the gym where somebody's doing something so stupid that you have to say something to them. You know, I had that kind of gym moment at the vitamin shop where I had to just, you know, make my wife and my babies wait in the car and school these bros on what the hell they're wasting their money on. I have a pretty major beef with unsubstantiated claims in the supplement world. All right. Okay. Whey and casein. Okay. There's a couple major differences between whey and casein, and they pretty much boil down to their speed of digestion and absorption. I mean, whey is the fast one, casein is the slow one, and they have these minor differences in their micronutrition or their biofractions. But really the sort of the dig there with whey and casein is whey is the greater promoter of protein synthesis, and casein is the greater promoter of antiproteolysis, or it's better at inhibiting protein breakdown. So those two processes, they really kind of go hand in hand. So I don't really see what the big issue is with having them both. It's probably optimal that way, but when you really boil it down, it probably doesn't matter. They're both high quality proteins. Nobody I know just eats whey and casein or casein as their sole protein source in the day. So it doesn't really matter all that much. If you were to nitpick towards the optimal, I would have both, because they just have slightly different actions, different functions, and they complement each other.
Now, Alan, let me throw something in there too, because that answer you kind of describe, I think, the feeling that most of us tend to share, which is, you know, look at your supplements, choose the ones that might get the most bang for the buck or most appropriate to your goals, but don't go crazy and stuff. But then, of course, there are other people that have maybe the opposite opinion, and the first person that would come to mind is Jose Antonio, and I think it was even the last article he wrote for the Sports Nutrition Insider from the ISSN. He talked more about why are people saying don't take supplements, just take them. If they work, great. If not, don't worry about them. But why should you have to eat well in order to allow you to take a supplement? Just take it and see what happens. So what would you say in response to that, understanding that we're putting words possibly in his mouth, but for those people that kind of look to just, I'm going to take every supplement that I can and don't control their diet, are they doing something wrong, or is there maybe something to that even if they're not eating properly?
There's definitely advantage if you are an early adopter or a supplement optimist, then you're going to be taking you're going to be reaping the full benefits of the placebo effect more than somebody like myself who almost has like an opposite placebo effect. I mean, you get to a point where there's, you know, it is possible to get cynical about things, and I try to check myself on that and give credit where it's due in the supplement world. However, yeah, the mechanism behind, or rather the benefit of being a supplement optimist and an early adopter, et cetera, is that you will take advantage of the placebo effect and you just might get better results from the guy who's right. A little more discriminating. So at the end of the rainbow, I think Joe Antonio might be right about the kill them all and let God sort them out sort of
right.
approach.
I think too, and I just wanted to interject quickly, is I know that at least myself, and I'm sure Alan with being on bodybuilding.com, I get a lot of questions about really out there supplements. And I think that a lot of time people aren't asking the questions about simple minerals and vitamins. And I don't think that in my position that there's where I'm speaking from, I don't think that there's any ever a problem with getting a few more vitamins. I'm not saying to supervose with like B12, like a lot of people do and things like that. But I think covering your simple, you know, zinc, mineral, potassium, you know, minerals and vitamins and bases like that, I don't think there's ever anything wrong with that. And I know that Jose, I think that some things that I've seen that he talks a lot about that. So I think where I personally come from more so is kind of the more out there supplements, you know, like a Swole times 10 max 3000, you know, yeah. Like that kind of stuff. You know, I
horny goat weed nano.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Sol pimento loaf. You know, that kind of thing. I think that is where the supplement lines get drawn when you get into that area versus just your basic supplementing with mineral and vitamins that you might not get in your diet. And I'm just throwing that out there from a personal view of where, because usually when a lot of people are talking about supplements, they're not actually talking about vitamins. They're not actually talking about things like that. They're talking about weird stuff that has been concocted in a lot.
The stuff that's behind the glass at Vitamin Shop.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I can imagine Joe Antonio referring to some of the more, substantiated stuff.
Yeah.
You know, some of the, like branched chain amino acids and, gosh, whatever the case may be. What is Joe Hawking these days? I can see that Joe referring to a bit more of the legit stuff rather than goat weed, horny goat weed, nano vapor, and things of that nature. And but again, it boils down to a philosophy. My philosophy regarding supplements is you take the least amount necessary. My lack of sleep is showing this sentence right here. You take the least amount of extra stuff necessary to get the best effect. So least amount of stuff begins with zero. And as soon as zero is not cutting it, then you add one. That sort of systematic approach to supplement use, what it does from a practical standpoint, it's economical. And from the physiological standpoint, it's one less compound that your body has to, in quotes, deal with in the face of very little long-term safety data in most of the compounds. And finally, what you do when you take that approach of least amount necessary to affect change, you have trump cards to pull during what I call end-stage plateaus in progress. So if you just throw all the tools out on the table at the very outset, then you don't have these trump cards to pull when the going gets tough with respect to either performance or body composition plateaus. So I think there's just a better, more methodical way to go about it rather than the whole shotgun approach.
Very good. Thank you for answering that question. I have a new one for you. let's see. The next question was, I had some blood work done a few weeks ago, and the doc said everything was good, but my testosterone levels were low. This sucks, considering I'm only 25 years old. As an anecdotal note, I certainly noticed that I have a harder time putting on muscle than my friends I work out with. Is there anything I can do to boost my testosterone that will actually work? I'm not asking for anything unnaturally high, just normal would be nice. Currently, I work out heavy and intense and eat a piss load of red meat. Quote unquote. I am not opposed to taking supplements and don't really want to go the illegal route, but I just want to know my options. I will be very interested to hear anything you guys can give me, and that's from Matthew.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at his age, 25, and at 25, you're pretty much, you don't really have that much of a grip on just how slow progress is in terms of just getting that ideal physique. I would assume that he is just kind of jumping the gun in a lot of respects. And even if he's not, let's say he's been pounding away at this progress thing since he was 18, diligently and intelligently, and he found out he's got low testosterone. I hate to say this, but generally speaking, unlike drug use, dietary manipulations that attempt to maximize test are, at best, they're just an exercise in preventing your levels from dropping, rather than optimizing the levels. For that, you need drugs. And this is because dietary extremes in either high or low protein have been seen to lower the active form of test, at least in the short term. So dietary extremes, if you want to avoid dips in testosterone, then you avoid dietary extremes. Another sort of guideline is that higher levels of dietary fat in the 30 to 40% range have performed better than 15 to 20% of calories when it comes to preserving testosterone levels. Lower fiber intake, less than 20 grams, as opposed to, you know, the recommended 25 to 35 grams per day. Has been shown to be more conducive to testosterone production. So actually, this unhealthy-ish sort of Atkinsy type of profile is what's really going to perhaps optimize your testosterone levels. But then again, you know, it's still debatable. It's still debatable that variations in dietary composition have any long-term effect on sex hormone levels. Okay, so. why are you laughing?
Sorry. I thought I muted my mic. My fault. Sorry. I thought I could laugh without having to. It's just text going in the background. We're just talking about Viper products. Now it's a great name for a supplement.
Alan, let me introduce you now to the. Let me introduce you to the weekly fail. Every week, Kevin inadvertently does something foolish or silly, and that's his fail, and you've just witnessed this week's fail.
No, that's cool. I can dig it, man. I, at least he wasn't laughing at the fact that I said it's debatable that variations in diet composition even matter at all for affecting sex hormone levels.
No, but that's
that,
just...
I took that as, oh, shit, nothing matters anymore. I thought he was just going to hang up and leave.
No, I'm in sixth grade.
Yeah, I think Kevin was just laughing at the word sex. Yeah, I think that's
nice.
What.
Nice.
I apologize.
So basically, you know, you can make all these dietary manipulations to supposedly optimize your hormone levels, and what the body does is just sort of self-regulates. It's got this. The body has a real powerful negative feedback type of tendency that just automatically balances out everything. In order to maintain a constant level of circulating androgens. So I wouldn't even focus I would throw out the idea of maximizing testosterone through diet. You do what you can do. You don't go too low in fat. You don't go too high in fiber. You get enough protein. You don't go too low in carbs. And on top of that, beyond that, the main thing you want to do is maximize net muscle protein synthesis. So you want to maximize protein synthesis through diet, which is a lot less complex, a lot more straightforward. So I would almost just abandon the original objective and go for net muscle protein synthesis.
And Alan, wouldn't it be something maybe for safe to say or to question that was he dieting down when he got his test taking? Does he just need to eat more, period? Wouldn't that...
Calories, yes.
Yeah, you know, like, wouldn't that to some degree be just something, like, you know, before he goes to the supplements that he could be missing? It's just, you know, up your calories.
Yeah, that could be possible,
especially since he's saying, like, he's a hard gainer. Because I don't know about you, but I see that a lot. You know.
Yeah, that's something I missed. Thanks for picking that up. Yeah, that's really important. Whenever you're chronically hypocaloric, your serum androgens are just going to be down in the shitter. So, yeah, it can be actually a question of just raising calories any which way but loose, whether it's through protein, carbs, or fat, or a combination.
Let's jump into the next question from Daniel. I've been working out for about 3 years now and never really put much thought into the idea of post-workout protein shakes until about 2 months ago. I'm already in my ideal physical shape at 5% body fat, and I'm quite happy with the results that I'm getting without the supplement. However, I was told that it actually helps your muscles recover better, resulting in a better workout the next time. This appears appeal to me since I do enjoy an intense workout. Anyways, while at GNC, I bought a brand called Power Max and paid a fairly steep price. Sorry, it's an intense name. And paid a fairly steep price. I saw another brand called 100% Whey Gold Standard for less than that. And had more protein per calorie. This seems like it was a more logical purchase, but the guy working at the desk said that Power Max had a higher amino acid profile. So my question is there any significant advantage to buying the more expensive Power Max, or is there less expensive Gold Standard, pretty much the same stuff?
Is this a softball lob?
Seriously, no, but, well, first thing, 5% body fat?
Yeah.
That's pretty low, bro.
You know, as for a client's request, I looked up body fat percentages of elite professional athletes. Talking not just professional, but elite professional athletes. And the low end was more often than not right around 6%. So this guy covering at 5%. I mean, man, got shredded. You know.
must have a great scale.
No,
electrical impedance is your friend if you try 12 times.
He must be a regular listener of the FitCast, obviously, because our audience.
He's being sarcastic. I think he's being sarcastic.
Extra special.
Well, I looked up Power Max, and it's a blend of whey and egg protein. And it's got a little glutamine, a little taurine added, and the two latter compounds have just not shown jack worth in terms of increases in size and strength in the literature. And so we're left with whey and egg protein, and then this little blend of enzymes called Aminogen. And Aminogen, it's got a single study behind it that's funded by the manufacturer, Gateway Health Alliances, and it shows that it makes the whey, it increases the rate of absorption of the whey. It's an acute study, and you're basically staking 40% higher price on a single short-term study funded by the manufacturer. And so there you have it. That's what you're placing your bets on, Aminogen. I think that just from the practical standpoint, if you were forced to choose, or from the hypothetical standpoint, if you were forced to choose between just whey protein or this PowerMax stuff, which is two different proteins, and that was your only protein source in your whole diet, you had this artificially concocted diet of just either this or that, then you go with the whey and the egg protein, and you go with PowerMax. But most people consume 5-6 different sources of protein in their diet every day, so spending 40% more for PowerMax over good old straight-ahead whey is just plain stupid.
Alan, next question is, what is your opinion on ZMA? I started taking it to improve my sleep quality, and it has worked. but could I get the same benefits from a more common and cheaper calcium magnesium zinc supplement? Is there any good evidence that calcium interferes with the magnesium and zinc absorption significantly, or that adding B6 vitamins in the mix helps somehow? Also, ZMA's effects seem to be stronger in the first months. I still notice an effect on my sleep if I stop taking it, but the difference does not seem to be as big anymore. Any thoughts? Thanks for your time. Posse from Finland.
I think a lot is going on in this person's mind that's leading, well, him or her to believe one thing or another about the supplement being taken. ZMA, it's been marketed for a couple different things. The main thing it's been marketed for in the sports supplement sense was its ability to raise anabolic hormones and increase strength and size and all that stuff. And that's been tested pretty recently, I think 2004-ish, and it failed pretty miserably for raising anabolic indexes and increasing strength. It didn't do any of that stuff. The one thing in ZMA that would improve sleep is magnesium. Mm-hmm. So it's not the zinc that's really doing anything for sleep. Pardon me, it's the magnesium. So if you want to save the money, just skip the ZMA and either A, make sure you're covered in terms of dietary magnesium, or B, just take magnesium by itself. But a lot of times a lack of sleep, and this is something I mentioned in the research review when I took a look at the study that a lot of the ZMA guys stake their whole claims on. A lot of times when you're lacking sleep, it's because of a magnesium deficiency and not necessarily because you need to be superdosing the stuff. So, and even beyond that, there's psychological issues that'll make people lack sleep that have much further reaching effects than nutritional issues, making people lack sleep. So maybe even a better sleep aid for somebody rather than taking ZMA is to just go see a shrink or something. You know, well, I guess that's not too economical, but the point is there are so many factors that could be affecting sleep that you can't necessarily pin it on taking ZMA or not. But if you choose to do that, then just go for the magnesium. And according to the Institute of Medicine, the upper safe level of magnesium would be about double BRDA. So about 700 milligrams total through diet and supplementation, or you can just do 300 to 400 milligrams of supplemental magnesium on top of whatever you're doing. And that will have the potential to get you to sleep better. Form of magnesium matters somewhat. Magnesium oxide is the least bioavailable form, so you want to go for magnesium aspartate, lactate, citrate, or sulfate, or even magnesium chloride. If you want to go the food route, increasing your magnesium, just crank up the halibut, crank up the almonds, soybeans, spinach. There's a number of ways to do it. But, you know, practically speaking, if somebody really wants to get the effect of ZMA, they can just toss everything out and just get extra magnesium.
All righty. The next question comes from Mary, and Mary writes, "Hi, Kevin. Could you ask Alan what he knows about the supplement 7-Keto to help with DHEA production, and if he feels it is beneficial, harmful in any way? Thanks, Mary." Now, Mary, Kevin could not ask this question, but I did, so I hope that's okay.
Sweet.
Yep.
7-Keto is actually a downstream metabolite, so it's a breakdown product of DHEA. So the way that she's phrasing her question is a little off, because you're not necessarily going to raise DHEA levels through taking 7-Keto. If through taking DHEA, you might raise 7-Keto levels. So, but then again, as always, you go to the evidence. Show me the evidence. Show me the money, man. What have we seen in research? How much of it is there? What's the quality of this research? Who's funding it? And are the effects even relevant in the real world? And so 7-Keto is, there's actually more than two trials of 7-Keto, but there's roughly four, maybe five, but there's only two that 7-Keto is by itself in a supplement. The other remaining two studies, it's within a concoction of other fat loss goodies. So we can pretty much throw those out because we can't single out 7-keto as the active agent in those results. So out of the two studies that show that it does anything at all, well, of course, these studies were funded by Humanetics, who's the patent holder of 7-keto. And then that one of the studies that might not have a vested interest in 7-keto was done in 2007. It showed that it increased resting metabolic rate by 1.4% per day. So this boiled down to burning an extra 21 calories per day if you're on 7-keto. So, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about burning an extra 21 calories a day, man, but I don't know. Doesn't get me too excited.
Sounds monstrous.
and then the whole, if we back up a little bit and look at the DHEA research and what's touted about DHEA, it's going to improve this and that. There's a whole battery of things that DHEA is supposed to improve, especially in terms of anti-aging type of stuff. Man, that it just fails over and over and over again for fulfilling the claims that it's touted for. So in the beginning, if you're trying to raise DHEA levels in the face of declining levels with age, you have to ask yourself, well, what's the evidence that does anything at all? And it doesn't exist. So Mary is kind of misguided from the outset by having the objective of raising DHEA levels in the first place. So save your money. Cost the 7-keto.
Bob has a question about food allergies. Can you address the general topic of food allergies, food intolerances, sensitivity, or whatever you want to call it? I hear quite a bit of conflicting information about this, setting aside the obvious allergy situations, like when someone gets hives and breathing difficulties after eating peanuts or shellfish. You hear claims about people being slightly bloated or feeling sluggish and so forth because they are unknowingly eating foods that they can't tolerate. Is there any actual research to support this notion?
Yeah, there is. There is, but a lot of it is self-reported survey-based research. And this is not to say that food allergies don't exist. They certainly do. And the most common allergens are peanuts, tea tree nuts, eggs, milk, wheat, soybeans, certain fish, and shellfish. But the actual prevalence of these food allergies, at least in the self-reported sense, is pretty low. So out of the whole population, or at least the United States, there is 5.3% of everybody, you know, 5.3% of the population is reporting a doctor-diagnosed food allergy. And out of that, there's even less that are self-reporting it based on the common food allergen. So there's 2.7% of the American population is reporting food allergies from the big eight, from the peanuts, tea tree nuts, eggs, milk, wheat, soybeans, fish, crustaceans, shellfish. There's only really, there's a pretty small percentage of folks who really get affected by these things. So if you're in the 95 some odd percent of the population who will not get affected by this stuff, what will affect you is a certain amount of expectation bias going in, hearing your crazy friends tell you they're allergic to 12, 15 different things. So this is kind of a soapbox point for me to just harp on the whole expectation bias thing. If you hear it enough that I've got a milk allergy, he's got a milk allergy, she's got a milk allergy, then you can basically trick yourself into having any kind of allergy that you want, depending on how strong your belief is in the food that might give you the allergy. And then, you know, tests for allergies are really it's sort of a delicate thing, man. The prick tests, blood tests, things of that nature. The only way you can find out a true food allergy is to double blind and placebo control a series of food challenges. You know, see what, just do some elimination stuff, and if you can, then double blind the thing, which is pretty much impossible for self experimentation. But I would caution against just assuming that you're allergic to one of the common eight. This is a tough question, and this is a gray area. I would mainly emphasize the fact that there is just a small percentage of people who truly are allergic to these things. And what I don't want to see is a lot of folks eliminating tons of foods that have a lot of important nutrition just to be able to sidestep allergies that they don't necessarily have. I know that's not the most awesome, conclusive answer, so that's the point that I turn it over to Lee for that.
I think the biggest thing, it's funny because you're talking to someone that just came back from the allergy doctor not 2 days ago.
Give you a list of 20 foods to not eat?
No, I went through the prick testing, and oh my God, it was vicious. And the woman was far too happy to stick me with a bunch of needles, by the way. And it's funny because they did the prick testing on me, and I'm like deathly allergic to like cats and like dust mites and like basically anything that has to do with grass or anything like that. Like I'm a nerd, whatever. But I got tested for all kinds of food allergies and stuff too, and they ran everything like that. And I've done a lot of research on allergies, and coming from someone who is very sensitive to I'm lactose intolerant, I'm very sensitive to like a lot of foods in the sense of whey protein doesn't like digest very well in my tummy. Like get a little gassy around me, so I try not to like eat it too much. But yes. There's a really big difference between intolerance or something just not necessarily agreeing with your tummy that well and being allergic. And then stating an intolerance as to a reason as why you're unhealthy or as to why you can't lose fat or as to why basically trying to pin it onto something. It's that old phrase and saying of, well, if it does that to me, then it can't be good. And then something else bad must be happening. Sometimes when you don't digest things well, you just don't digest things well. It doesn't mean that you're all of a sudden going to implode. And it doesn't mean that all of a sudden that you're just going to start to metabolize things different and things don't work in your body. A lot of people don't seem to understand that just because you eat some cream cheese and it doesn't agree with you, that all of a sudden your metabolism is messed up and you're going to die from a horrible pesticide, disease-ridden, hormone-filled thing that is giving you some sort of an illness. It just doesn't work that way. Your body doesn't change its rhythm and how it does things just simply because you eat something that leaves you a little gassy. And I think that that's where people are getting it wrong. I think that's where people are getting scared. They eat something, it doesn't agree with them, all of a sudden they claim that they're allergic to it, and then therefore that allergy is going to cause them to be very ill. Or going to cause them to not lose weight properly, or cause them to be very, very sick in general overall, instead of it just being, I just don't digest that well. And there's a lot of research that I do in inflammation and in enzyme production, probiotics, and all that kind of thing, glutamine and its health with digestive ability and gut health in general. And most of the time, the problem is not allergies. Most of the time, the problem is the gut. And it's how well the gut can just process things, how well you're eating in general, stress, things that are very easy to control, that are very easy for you to take control of in your diet and take control of in just your lifestyle in general, and that are not big, scary things. They're just small little things that you can do to make yourself feel a little better. I 100% believe that you can kind of overtax your system sometimes. I don't think that that's a crazy notion, but I don't believe that that you should be afraid of food or running of things just simply because you happen to eat something that didn't agree with you. And I think that that's where, because I get on soapboxy about this a lot too. I don't agree with people cutting elimination diets and I can't eat beef. I have to eat lamb because lamb is safer. What? Really? Like that doesn't even make sense. It doesn't even make sense. There's absolutely no reasoning for that whatsoever. I've looked into like all these things, and there's no reasoning for it whatsoever to cut out certain things, but other things are okay. Like I don't understand why rice is not okay, but quinoa is. Like, why? Really?
Iron protein.
You know what I'm saying?
Because it tastes yummy.
It does taste good, and there's nothing wrong with it. But you know what I'm saying? It's just we keep eliminating foods that it's okay to eat because we keep running out of things to blame. Oh, well, it was the rice. I'm switching to couscous because couscous is going to help me lose weight and get less bloated. And I don't know if people know this, but when you eat over your caloric intake, sometimes it bloats you. Shocking, I know.
It's been a while.
Shocking. And when you eat carbohydrates, you do pull in water. I know that it's the most blasphemous thing ever on the face of the earth to hear, but it is true. And I think that it's just it's a constant finger point as to why your results aren't having the way that you want them to have, and that's what's led us to have so many self-diagnoses on message boards. And, you know, everyone is gluten intolerant. And if you have a gluten problem, chances are you're having a hard time keeping your weight, not necessarily losing your weight. It's just, it goes on and on. But, I could rant about it all day, obviously. But
Well, people with certain intolerances or allergies, they have a tendency to project that upon everybody else.
Absolutely.
They have a tendency to suggest it, project it. Hey, maybe you have this. And it almost becomes a hypochondriac party.
Yes.
So, you know.
I 100% agree.
I guess I'll grab the next question again from Ben. Are you familiar at all with the HCG diet? It supposedly involves injections of a hormone made by pregnant women in order to cause the body to dip into its fat reserves. What is your opinion on this? I've had several clients ask me about it, Ben.
Well, the HCG diet, it's really old one, and it's more than 50 years ago. This guy, this physician actually, named Albert Simeons, he believed that HCG injections would mobilize stored fat, suppress appetite, and just somehow redistribute fat in a more, aesthetic way. You know, basically, I mean, the HCG, what its biological function is, it's to promote the development of the fetus. So there isn't even a solid theoretical basis to use it for fat loss per se. So nevertheless, the Simeons guy, apparently he was pretty popular in the 70s to the point where it sort of raised the eyebrows of the researchers who investigated his claims and completely were able to debunk them. There's even a meta-analysis done. And for those of you who are not familiar with what that is, a meta-analysis is a systematic pooling of studies where you take a look, sort of an aerial bird's eye view of the results of a group of studies on a given topic, and you kind of draw kind of a conclusion based on the pooling of all these studies. And I'll quote them. We conclude that there is no scientific evidence that HCG is effective in the treatment of obesity. It does not bring about weight loss or fat redistribution, nor does it reduce hunger or induce a feeling of well-being. And pretty much there you have it. And I guess the kicker here is the Simeons protocol of HCG shots also involved a 500-calorie-a-day diet. So it's pretty obvious what was working.
Yeah. This is the last question. Alan, can you explain? Can you ask Alan if he can explain his research review? So, Alan, I'm going to ask you if you can please explain your research review.
I'm explaining.
And how those who might be interested in subscribing. How they would subscribe if they get past editions. Basically, Alan, this is time for you to pimp yourself. Please do so.
I can tell you're earnestly trying to coach me on this, Lee.
I want to make sure that you don't miss anything because I want the listeners.
Well, this is a real question.
Yeah, this is a real question. I want the listeners to make sure that they get the full benefit and that they immediately go and subscribe to the research review.
Okay. All right. So the research review is it originated from me realizing that Lyle McDonald knew more than I did. it just kind of went on from there. Yeah, but and that is kind of serious actually. But the research review is, I've been through school for quite a long time. I'm done with that. I've been in private practice for a long time, and so I would like to think that I have a pretty balanced experience of the academic side as well as the practical side, and I've been able to apply knowledge to some pretty high-stakes clients. And what I didn't have going through school or when I was in the earlier stages of my interests, and even in some of the more advanced stages of my interests in fitness theory, application of, you know, performance enhancement and or body composition alteration, what I didn't have was a resource that kind of that was not affiliated with a commercial entity, a resource that was as honest as possible, no sort of ties that would bias it, and a resource that would bridge the gap between the incredibly boring writing style of the primary research and the salesy, cheesy writing style of typical online articles. So, and also I wanted to keep, I didn't want to compromise the technical level or the level of intellectual integrity in the publication. So I've somehow found a way to kind of bridge that gap between the primary research and what the highly enthusiastic lay audience would be able to digest and put to use. So that's the research review in a nutshell. And it consists of, and I'll just break it down, like each issue consists of an opening article where I take some sort of topic, like for example, one of my favorites was so much ado about insulin hindering fat loss, so little evidence. Or another topic I looked at was the, I called it Buried in Hope, and I took a look at the claims of exotic fruit juices. What are they claiming? What's the evidence? And another one of my favorite topics was even things like rep range for hypertrophy. What's the evidence there? What are the mechanisms that people are discussing and why? And I just have all these questions in my mind about, okay, does this topic have a bunch of research on it? And can we take a look at the research at from an aerial view and dissect it and come up with any meaningful conclusions? And I think it's great when we can actually do that with certain topics. There's just a ton of things that I really immerse myself in and just lay it all out, because I'm not biased towards anything. I don't have a vested interest in saying this thing sucks or this thing is great. I mean, this is just a quest for knowledge. I mean, we're trying to find the truth and stuff, and I try to factor everything in. So the opening of each issue is a literature review of a given topic. The Taubes thing was one of those things where I just kind of went off topic because it's my publication. I can kind of go off when I please, which is kind of a cool thing. Because I working for the bigger boys like Men's Health and stuff, there's a certain amount of restriction within the freedom that they give me. But with the research review, it's all me. It's all what I want to write about. It's all how deep or how harsh I want to dig into anything. And I'm just laying out all the facts in as truthful of a way as I could possibly lay out. In addition to doing a review article at the beginning, I will take a look at supplementation research, diet and exercise research, and sort of archival and semi-archival research. And just because research is a few months old or a few years old, that doesn't mean that it's now obsolete. Mm-hmm. So I take a look at research studies in terms of their strengths, their weaknesses, their applicability. I cross-check the results with what I've seen from just an observational standpoint in the field. And then I pull these things together, and I try to give people a better understanding of what gets filtered out into the mass media. I mean, a lot of research that makes headlines is usually just taken out of context. It's usually sound bites taken out of context from correlational studies, and it just makes good headlines. So I think it's really important for folks to know what's the deal behind eggs and cardiovascular disease. I was pretty shocked when I investigated that. I exhausted the egg literature and found that, hey, man, I'm kicking ass by eating my whole eggs in a lot of them. I mean, within the confines of my macronutrient targets. And just hearing that doesn't mean a whole lot, but when you look at the research behind this stuff, it'll definitely open your eyes. What I'm planning on looking at in future issues is the supposed metabolic advantage of low-carbohydrate diets. I'll look at paleo dieting. I'll look at taking numbers and building diets. I'll look at qualitative approaches to dieting. Just a few things down the pipeline. What I also end up doing is interviewing experts or people who I think are worthwhile. And so I've interviewed Ronnie Coleman. Yes, I have.
Nice.
For you bros out there. And he does do Pilates, by the way. He started doing Pilates about 8 months ago. So if you can picture Ronnie Coleman doing Pilates, then you pretty much made it.
Lightweight, baby.
Lightweight. thanks for throwing that in. And it's just, for me, this is the culmination of what I feel are my strengths, which are the ability to communicate important factual info to real people and people who are serious about fitness in either a recreational sense or a professional sense. I'm pretty much going to take myself to the grave with doing this research review because I work hardest on it more than any other project. And I'm not ashamed to put it that way. I'm losing hairs and they're turning gray over this research review, but damn it, I'm getting smarter, and so is everybody else. And that's it. I actually thought of some sort of promotional hook to try to get some subscribers right off the bat, but, you know, like how you get, like, a week cruise with me, you know, first 100 subscribers get to get a naked pic of me or whatever. But you know what, man, just ask people who are subscribed what you think of it. Then you'll end up subscribing. And this is my thing, man. I'm passionate about this thing, and trust me, nobody's getting rich off it because it appeals to a very narrow niche of just really discriminating, very smart folks, and that's fine with me. So that's it.
I think you had Kevin at naked pic, actually.
Yeah. If you would have said boobs, I think that your subscriptions would have gone up by 10 at least.
At least.
But just keep hitting add to cart 10 times.
Yeah.
See if I get 10 pictures.
But I'll tell you what, too. I mean, I think even though, Alan, you didn't feel like you knew exactly how to sell it, I think the product sells itself. And I think that when we look at the types of stuff that we would do here on the FitCast, or the types of things that, or at least we try to, and the things that you actually do in your newsletter, I mean, it's all about helping other people to understand the mounds of research and literature that's out there, and to discern it from the bro logic or the gym chatter of my sister's boyfriend's brother got huge doing this type of stuff, and actually looking at not only what does the research say, but what does the research not say, and to making sense of that. Because evidence-based practice, as we understand it, it's not just about what does this study say, but does this study actually say something that's valid? And if there's no evidence for what we do, is it because it doesn't work and we're just fooling ourselves, or is it because we haven't found a way to actually understand why it works yet? So things like that are just, I mean, you can't you can't put a price on that. I mean, that's how we get our information. That's how we make the right decisions in our training or our nutrition. And it's really it's these types of resources that make someone excel at what they're trying to accomplish and give them the results that they're really after versus just going at it and having no idea. So I think this stuff like that is just absolutely fantastic.
Well, thanks for that, John. And I want to emphasize that the people who will appreciate this are not necessarily, you don't have to have 3 nutrition and training degrees to appreciate this stuff. One thing that I've learned with writing and just communication through the written word is that my goal is to not write like primary researchers write. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm getting better at that and still conveying the data in the accurate way it needs to be sent across. And I forgot to mention that there's a closing section in the review called In the Lay Press, and I will take a look at articles online, articles on in the mass media that are just shoved down the lay public's throat, and I'll critically analyze them, and I'll even include references in some cases. My latest one that I looked at was Super Slow Training. Mm. I bet you guys know quite a little bit about that, Jonathan and Kevin.
I think I'm doing it right now, actually.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, I was surprised that there was I didn't think that there would be a whole lot of meaningful data to discuss behind the super slow training thing. But interestingly enough, I was able to compile a good amount of data and draw some conclusions. It was pretty funny, admittedly. especially when you dig through the super slow site. Which, you know what, man, those guys mean well. You know they mean well.
Yeah, of course.
but yeah, and it's things like that. And I have a lot of fun with it, and I have a lot of I'm going to be having a lot of great interviews come down, but just a lot of good content, and I don't know, I just can't, I'm dumbfounded now. I don't know what to say.
Well, I got to say something, because through research papers and my senior thesis in college, I freaking hated going through research papers. It's just, they're hard to read, it just feels like you're doing twice as much work to read half as much content when you have to actually pull out the piece of research from PubMed or wherever. But the reason why I like it so much is like you said, in the beginning you always just take a lot of studies and you kind of break it down and you make it easy enough to read for anyone, and it's just a lot less taxing on the brain. I will never be one of those guys that just goes out and like, yeah, you know what, I'm interested in this, I'm going to go pull down 20 studies and go through every one and then set up graphs and charts. Like, it's just so much easier for me, and I think it's great that you're doing this to allow people out there to hear what's going on in a lot of different fields and what's going on in the research, and just, break it down and make it easy for everyone to understand.
Well, a lot of the students who are subscribed, they appreciate the fact that every study that I put in there, I link it, and so they can just go ahead and grab it immediately, and they can get through their term papers easier or whatever they're going to use.
Yeah, I wish
for.
I had this. It would have been a lot easier to write some papers back in college.
but yeah, I mean, there's a free issue that you can check out. It's the January issue of 2008. And I personally think that I've gotten the issues to a different level, a much better level than the January issue, but you can check it out anyway. And the actual link is alanaragon.com/researchreview. And that's where you'll be able to see the description and the write-up and the sample issue. So, yeah, alanaragon.com/researchreview, or you can just go to alanaragon.com and dig your way through there. And that is me rolling non-organic white flour pizza dough on the homepage.
Yeah, there it is.
Just blew minds across the country. Well, we'll make sure to also link to that in the show notes for those of you out there that are too lazy to remember that, or are in the car right now and don't have access to the internet. Well, what do you guys think? I think that will pretty much wrap it up.
I think so.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, and thanks a lot for coming on, and we hope to have you on again sometime in the future.
No, I'm looking forward to it, guys. And I think you guys are doing a great job. And I did listen to a bunch of FitCast episodes leading into this because I wanted to get up to speed. And you guys, definitely, you're hilarious, man. You guys crack me up.
John, before we go, you got to give a pink dumbbell award to an actual. And I said actual wrong again.
Actual.
It'll never be right.
Whatever. Just give it to a fucking listener, John, and let's get going.
Wow.
I'm just kidding. I'm not trying to be mean. Let's.
Lee, you really got to bump this kid's calories, man.
Pink dumbbell.
Yeah.
Award. Who are you giving it to, John? This is your thing.
I mean,
John, you're not even. I bet you don't even have one. That's why you're stalling.
Leppel Hill, just because they. Just because they called Lee Leppel Hill again.
Right, Robert, congratulations.
Robert.
Pink Dumbbell Award. Shoot me an email and I'll send you out a t-shirt.
I hate you all. You all suck.
Dude, Leppel's like the new Oprah.
I've been cussed out. My name's been said wrong.
Leppelhill.net?
You're a very funny, starving man there, Kevin Larrabee.
I'm sorry. No, it's leepeel.com. You can check out John's stuff at acceleratestrength.com. And, of course, Alan is at alanaragon.com. That's it for us. Please check out thepickass.com. Check us out on iTunes. We'll see you next week, folks. Take care. Discussion. We got Alan. John, just calm down, all right? I'll boot you off the call again.
Dude, it's 7 in the morning Pacific time, man. Just relax.
Got Alan Aragon along with John and Lee Peel of LeePeel.com.
I'm totally awake, and I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's not a joke that I say Lee's last URL wrong anymore.
Nope.
And it's I think I have to find something new to do.
So Lee, what was the pizza thing you wanted to talk about?
Dude, okay, so I'm listening to the FitCast. I actually have this written down.
Wow, she came
the
with
FitCast,
the books.
No, the FitCast is not pizza, really? I missed that. I wasn't there for that statement.
What was wrong with it, Lee? What was wrong?
The FitCast, you know, it's not pizza.
We weren't on top of our game last week. We didn't.
No, I was I was exhausted.
I had to comment on that. I was laughing my ass off.
Good comment.
When I heard that, I really was.
Yeah, there were a lot of fails in there, and I was too tired to even call them out.
FitCast is not pizza.
Tell me where he's not telling the truth in that statement. That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
Well, I there's some people that can't eat pizza. You know.
Well, then their life sucks.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm. I have pizza in my avatar, just so you guys know. That is pizza, though. I'm not sitting there scrubbing my counter clean with my sundae. That's pizza dough. It's not whole wheat pizza dough.
Oh.
Just so want to clear that.
Yeah, but is that kind of like weird West Coast pizza where you put pineapples and stuff on it?
Nah, man. I try to make it as East Coast as humanly possible. You know,
excellent.
All that cute stuff. And so, yeah, I'm there, man. I'm in the zone as far as pizza goes.
Good, man.
You know it, man.
Anything else you guys want to talk about in the off topic? I know Lee missed out on it last week.
UFC was last night.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Crap, that's right, it was.
Yeah, it kind of sucked.
Okay, don't tell me. Don't even tell me.
I won't.
God. I'm trying to remember who was you. Okay, I want to go with Rich.
Okay.
Am I wrong?
Yeah. yes, but everyone in the bar disagreed with the call. It came down to decision, and honestly, like, I thought that I think we scored it that I'm trying to remember. I think Rich Franklin had the first round, and then Silva had the last two, or maybe Silva had the first and the third, but it was something along those lines. It was a relatively close fight, so it wasn't as like an offensive call as, you know, some other fights have been where you're like, you got to be kidding me. But it really didn't feel that way to any of us in the bar, and it was an entire Buffalo Wild Wings full of drunken UFC revelers. So it really, yeah, it was controversial.
Well, I'm pretty surprised that Silva hung in there, man. He's been looking pretty punch drunk in interviews and just seems just kind of toasty, you know? I mean, he's a legend. He's one of my favorites, but, dude, he's been done for a little bit. I'm surprised he hung in there.
You know what? Not even that, though, but he knocked Rich Franklin around a couple times. I mean, Rich Franklin can't take the punch that he used to either. And both of them, you could see, were off that game. They didn't have that explosive, just go in and destroy the opponent type of attack that they used to. But so there was a point or two where Silva had Franklin, and the old Silva would have absolutely just annihilated him. But both of them, like, they both got good shots in, both had control at one point or another. Franklin tossed him around. Silva actually had a good control in the clinch a couple of times, but there was nothing, like, you were just waiting for that one big punch or nothing at all because there was nothing in between.
Well, you know, obviously things could have went different depending on who took the spike shooter.
Pretty much. A good call. Good call. Not a banned substance. But it should be.
I'm not positive
just that,
about that.
Right.
I'm just gonna assume everyone's on the up and up.
Not a banned substance, but you know what? It's so powerful and potent, it should be.
Spike?
I love it.
All right.
Was that good? Was that a good off-topic banter opener?
Good.
As far as the fit cast goes?
Yeah, it was good for the four UFC fans that we have.
You're a liar. UFC fans, I want you to write in and...
You're going to get a lot of email about that one, though.
That's right.
I still can't get into it because it's like UFC 98. Like WrestleMania 23.
Right,
but
if it's Mike Tyson's Punch-Out 2, then it becomes a big deal.
There was no Mike Tyson's Punch-Out 2. There was just Super Punch-Out.
Oh, right, of course.
I've been watching Razor Ramon videos, mainly the interviews.
Nice.
Just so you know. I'm a fan.
Let's see. I got nothing else unless you guys want to move on.
Lee, do you see what you're doing to this poor boy in his low-carb days?
I know. I feel...
No, seriously, like, Lee, I love you, but fuck you today.
Aww.
Like, sorry. No, but seriously. No, fuck you. I just had to get that off my chest. Sorry. I feel better now.
Does that feel good to cuss me out, Kevin?
Oh, crap, we're still recording this. Yeah, you know what? Actually, yeah. People can hear this. That's fine. I have no problem with that. Professionally, it might hurt me in the future.
Professionally, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'd like to state, for the record right now, you fucking suck.
Yeah. And same thing with Tony Gentlecore. Gentlecore's a little bitch. Go to some explosive calf races. I have not seen Tony in a week, so there's no reason for me to say that, but...
You just felt like throwing it in?
I know.
Throwing
Tony's
everybody
like,
in the bus right now?
Yeah, Tony's like, oh, I can't wait to go see Up. I'm like, really, dude? You're like 32 years old. Like, you're not bringing
Up
kids to see the movie.
Up looks cute. Seriously. When that dog says... I love you. Squirrel.
I still
like,
haven't seen Star Trek.
Yet. Some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen in my entire life.
Mm.
No?
Yeah. No.
All right.
Looks kind of cool. I see it.
Yeah, I finally saw Wall-E like last
Wall-E's
weekend.
Wall-E's good. Yeah.
I finally saw it.
You know, you guys, I want to put in a plug for iRobot for a rental. Man, that thing is just awesome.
Was it?
I don't know. Yeah, it's so awesome that I can ignore Will Smith's Scientology. That's how awesome it is.
Wow. That's a lot of awesome.
Plug in there for some good movie making. iRobot.
Well, you know that now that everyone kind of has a bad taste in their mouth from Tom Cruise, he went back to J.J. Abrams and is trying to have him make Mission Impossible 4 now because no one else wants to make a movie with him.
Oh, crap. So. You know, true story, I have a high school friend who got into porn for a little bit, and he looked like Tom Cruise, and so naturally he adopted the stage name of Tom Screws, and that's a true story. It's a true story. The last time I saw that guy was in church, actually. Well, hey, what's up?
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Last time I saw him was in church.
Tom Screws. Met the guy in church a few years later.
Through 137 episodes, that's the best story I've ever heard.
Absolutely.
There's more where that came from.
There's no question in my mind that that wins the Pink Dumbbell Award for the week.
Right off the bat.
There's no question.
We're negative 9 minutes into the show.
Wow. That was great. Tom Screws. There you go.
All right, that's how we're going to end it. We're going to record the show now. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.